My guest today, Dr. Christopher Davidson, is an associate professor in Middle East politics in the School of Government and International Affairs at Durham University in Northeast England and a member of the Institute for Middle East and Islamic Studies. Before coming to Durham, he was assistant professor at Zayed University in the United Arab Emirates and a visiting associate professor at Kyoto University in Japan. He has published 6 books, edited 2 volumes, and a number of scholarly journals and chapters in other collections. His latest book, Shadow Wars, A Secret Struggle for the Middle East, of more than 670 pages, including footnotes, involved going through declassified files, leaked correspondences, and court subpoena documents, as well as interviews with former intelligence officials. It was published in October 2016 and selected for both the Cambridge Literary Festival and the Financial Times Weekend's Oxford Literary Festival. And its conclusions are one of the things we'll speak about today. Welcome, Chris Davidson, to Takes on the World.
Many thanks for having me on your show. It's a great delight.
Well, it's a great pleasure, and you've opened my eyes, which I thought were pretty wide open, to some other information that I did not have. I first contacted you after reading your article, Middle East Eye, about the efforts of Saudi Arabia to isolate Qatar and shut down Al Jazeera, and then learned about your recent book, Shadow Wars, which was published in Britain, which sheds an unpleasant light on the U.S. and its relations with the terrorist organizations it claims to be fighting against. But let's start with the Saudis' efforts to isolate Qatar, which was launched soon after Trump's visit to Riyadh. Could you sort out that for us?
Well, we've got a very important situation developing here now in the Persian Gulf, where Qatar, right next to Saudi Arabia, has been running a sort of semi-independent foreign policy for the past few years. In particular, it's been heavily funding this very well-known Al Jazeera international news network, which it's very important to point out has been heavily criticizing Saudi Arabia and other allies of Saudi Arabia. On top of that, Qatar has been heavily funding groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, which, of course, came to power briefly in the wake of the Arab Spring in Egypt in 2011. And the problem, as far as Saudi Arabia is concerned with all of this, is that Qatari-financed Muslim Brotherhood and Muslim Brotherhood-like groups across the region are essentially offering an alternative path towards Islamic governance to that offered by Saudi Arabia. Political Islam through the ballot box, if you like, rather than necessarily requiring a hereditary monarchy like the Al-Saud dynasty. I think much of this current development is heavily connected to the new U.S. administration. Saudi Arabia and its close ally, the United Arab Emirates, tried to do something about...
Excuse me, Chris, you're kind of going in and out. Could you stay closer to the phone? And because your voice level seems to be rising and falling here, so... But keep going, yes.
So we've got a situation where Saudi Arabia and its close ally, the United Arab Emirates, tried to do this before Qatar in 2014. It eventually petered out. It didn't really lead to anything. They backed off eventually. But now I think they realize that in the White House, they have an ally of sorts. Someone has given them a green light and de facto backing, as we saw from Trump's Twitter feed the other week, essentially joining Saudi Arabia in pointing the finger at Qatar and accusing Qatar of all manner of things, including the sponsorship of terrorist groups.
It's interesting that it happened just after, I mentioned earlier, before I called you, that the Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, his foreign policy advisor, hardly embraced the young now Crown Prince Salman, who is the one who launched the war on Yemen and seems to be actually making the Saudis more openly aggressive as opposed to staying in the background as they have much of the time as U.S. allies.
Yeah, you know, we've got a situation here where Trump and his team are all about trying to get investment into the United States. So a more warlike Saudi Arabia, whether it's bogged down in conflict in Yemen, whether it's fighting proxy wars with Iran elsewhere in the region, is essentially going to be a Saudi Arabia that has to keep spending very heavily on U.S. arms imports. In other words, the price of its protection will keep going up. And if you're a business-focused White House that's trying to bring as much investment to the United States as possible, this really seems to suit you. We know, of course, from the Trump campaign trail, he was repeatedly stating that he would try and get the Gulf states to pay up, as it were, to pay for their long history of U.S. protection, which from his perspective, I think, they've been more or less free riders.
Of course, what he didn't realize, but if it was not for the Saudis, the U.S. arms industry would not nearly be as profitable as it is. I mean, they have essentially, before now, over the years, bought billions of dollars of weapons, which they really weren't using. And their contracts kept U.S. plants humming. As a matter of fact, back in 1991, when they told George Bush Sr. that they couldn't afford to buy an order of jets that were being made by McDonnell Douglas in St. Louis, Bush said, you have to do it. We'll find a payment plan. And they arranged a payment plan. And when the Saudis signed that contract again, they partied all night in St. Louis. It was a small article in the local San Francisco paper. But we have been very much dependent on this, like a kickback. You buy our weapons, it seems, and we'll protect you. Does that sound reasonable?
Right, absolutely. As you rightly point out, much of this sophisticated Western weaponry, and a lot of it's British and French as well, has up until recently been lying to rot and gather dust in the desert in Saudi Arabia. It hasn't really been used up until a couple of years ago with the beginning of the Yemen war. So this was really part of a sort of global protection racket, if you like, where Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states had to do two things, really. They had to make sure that they recycled a significant chunk of their oil revenue back into the West economy. And that was done through these arms purchases. It was done through investing in U.S. Department of Treasury bonds, investing in the British and French economies too. And in return for that, there'd be a sort of a feeling that they would get protection from the West. Because after all, for countries like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait 1990 is the nightmare scenario. It's a militarily superior neighbor, Iraq, rolling the tanks in, the Gulf states being unable to defend themselves. And they know as well today as they did back then that without the United States and its allies, Kuwait would be part of Iraq today. So this has been a very significant part of the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States. As you also mentioned, there are entire cities and entire factory plants in the West which rely almost exclusively on single mass orders of military equipment from certain Gulf states. Without those orders continuing, those plants would literally have to shut down.
And they were very clever also, because the arms dealers, arms manufacturers, managed to control the votes of members of the U.S. Senate and Congress by having factories in every state. So Bernie Sanders, who is otherwise an anti-war candidate, would be anti-war, doesn't complain or say a word about the weapons plants in his state. It's just, it's part of the way it is. Now, one thing that I'm not even aware that the Trump knew, that Qatar is the home to the largest U.S. air base in the region. And I know the pressure on the Defense Department to move that air base, but that simply isn't a realistic proposition, is it?
This is a very significant U.S. facility. It's a major air base, as you mentioned, and it's also the forward headquarters of CENTCOM, so the U.S. military command for Central Asia that's responsible for the situation in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere. I think what's happened here is there's been significant pressure building up in Congress and elsewhere in the United States for the U.S. to move its military facilities out of Qatar, as evidence continues to build to point to Qatar as some sort of very permissive zone in which terror financing, including financing for Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, can take place. But I think now we've got a situation where Saudi Arabia and the UAE, with their current quarrel with Qatar and the pressure they're placing on Qatar, have very likely offered the Trump administration a deal that their military base in Qatar can remain intact, will be guaranteed, will be honored, etc., provided they provided that they get presidential backing in their quarrel with Qatar. And in that way, it will sort of remove a headache for the U.S. government. It won't need to move its facilities because it can argue that Qatar is under new leadership, or at the very least, Qatar has had to abandon its more dubious elements of its foreign policy, which both Saudi Arabia and the UAE are asking it to do.
You, in your article in Middle East Eye, there is a map of U.S. bases, military bases in the Gulf, which one doesn't see in the U.S. press. It's quite intimidating if you're somebody, if you're, let's say, Iran, for example, or some potential adversary of the United States. But in this situation, it seems that this attack by the blockade of Qatar by the Saudis has kind of backfired in the sense it'll cause problems for the U.S. because now it's brought Qatar, which is a Wahhabist Sunni, closer to Iran. They share this underground, underwater natural gas field, and also the Turks has got in onto it, and they have a base evidently in Qatar, and they and the Iranians are aligned with Qatar. This seems to have kind of backfired on the Saudis, and kind of. The United States has this love-hate relationship with Turkey, but they can't afford to offend Erdogan too much. How do you see all this playing out?
Yeah, this is becoming increasingly complicated, you know, a sort of scenario developing, perhaps not dissimilar to that in 1914 at the beginning of the First World War. I think certainly from the Saudi perspective, they've underestimated the commitment that both Turkey and Iran have demonstrated towards Qatar. As you mentioned, from the Turkish side, they've started to augment their very small base of just a few hundred soldiers in Qatar by also sending some tanks there, which have arrived in the past few days. Iran, meanwhile, has been launching these food aid flights to get food and basic commodities into Qatar, given the de facto closing down of Saudi airspace and the land border, which was previously the main route for Qatar getting its food supplies in. Of course, it's very complicated. Turkey is a major NATO power lined up against Saudi Arabia, which is the U.S.'s principal ally in the region. So at the moment, we've got a sort of standoff. There's no doubt that Qatar is not going to back down. The demands that Saudi Arabia and the UAE have made, including the full closure of Al Jazeera, seem too much for Qatar to bear. It would be a de facto abandoning of its foreign policies and its sovereignty even if it went ahead with this. So we've entered into this sort of phony war period, if you like, with neither side really knowing quite how to move forward on this one.
You know, I haven't watched all the media, but I do read the New York Times. Kind of a masochist, but I feel obliged to read it every day to see what the establishment wants us to know or believe. But I've yet to see any of our great advocates for press freedom speaking on behalf of Al Jazeera. How about on the side?
Yeah, you know, the story with Al Jazeera is a very confusing one. You know, you and I, when we watch Al Jazeera, we have to bear in mind we're watching Al Jazeera English. And that channel is pretty good, you know. It's a good alternative to BBC and so on. It's done some very hard-hitting reporting on Africa and the Middle East and Asia. It's a very, very good channel. The problem is that Al Jazeera English isn't the full story. Al Jazeera Arabic is the channel that's watched by many, many millions of Arabs around the world, and that's the one that has taken these very controversial stances on political Islam and the conflicts in Syria. Libya, and has been criticizing Saudi Arabia. So it's really all about Al Jazeera Arabic. Al Jazeera Arabic does have a strong viewpoint. It's a bit like sort of watching a pro-Islamist version of Fox News every day and then broadcasting that around hundreds of millions of Arabic-speaking populations.
Now, Qatar he has been a supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood. And actually, one time the Saudis were allied with back in the days, the earlier period. So it seems there's a great, I would use the, I think, as a big Nebrzinski talked, a chess game, and maybe that should take us into how we got into this mess in the first place and the role the British and later the Americans have played in creating the so-called terrorist crisis that we've seen going back to Afghanistan in 1979, where the Saudis and the U.S. got together to fund and arm the Mujahideen, which led to al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and so on. Perhaps you could... And how this has worked, this has actually worked in the U.S. behalf, that it's not, that this is, who benefits from this has been actually the United States and to Britain. Maybe you could talk about that.
Yes, I mean, if we were to trace this back way into the early part of the 20th century, there was a recognition by Britain that conservative religious forces in the Islamic world were a potential ally. Whether against the Bolshevik regime after 1979 in Central Asia, and of course in the Cold War context as well, because the sort of religion being espoused by countries like Saudi Arabia, the Afghani insurgency, the Islamist insurgency there, were essentially a counterweight to the more secular message coming out of the Soviet Union and coming out of the nationalist regimes, which were seen as potentially taking economic monopolies out of the hands of Western companies in Egypt, for example, in Iraq and Syria, and eventually in the 1970s in Afghanistan. And it really all sort of comes together by 1979, 1980, where in Afghanistan, the West identifies this opportunity to bring in, to fund, to militarily equip a hardline conservative Islamist insurgency to actually bring the fight to a Soviet ally to try and draw the Soviet Union into a sort of Vietnam of its own. And this really helps us understand why Saudi Arabia was cultivated not just as a oil-rich partner, not just as a buyer of Western weapons, but also as an exporter of right-wing conservative Islam across the region, which was ultimately seen as a way to keep in place the more secular nationalist governments. Of course, to our horror today, when we unpick it, we realize that in the 1980s in Afghanistan, the CIA's Operation Cyclone, the biggest CIA operation in history, essentially gave us al-Qaeda as it helped fund a lot of Arabia, the Mujahideen resistance against the Soviet-aligned government in Kabul, which, of course, it eventually beat. So we have the Taliban. As a result of this, we have al-Qaeda, which was responsible for bringing Islamist fighters across the border from Pakistan. And we have a whole host of other Islamist fighting groups, many of which are still with us today, including the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which was given birth to in the Afghan Jihad as well. And, of course, it's members of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and their current generation in England, in Manchester, which gave us the bomber a few weeks ago.
You know, it's an extraordinary story. And when going back to Afghanistan in the 80s, you had this Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, pronounce his name, Hekmatyar, who is one of the most vicious warlords, is now, it seems, back welcome in the Afghan government. He's very old, but this... Yeah. And Americans know very, very little about the government that existed in Afghanistan that the U.S. thought was too pro-Soviet, how it opened schools, development for women, and so on in a way that it hasn't since. And this was seen as a threat because it was on the Soviet border, and Brzezinski wanted to give Russia its own Vietnam. He still claimed that doing what he did was worth it. Maybe come on that.
Yeah, from his perspective, you know, he was trying to win the Cold War, and arguably the Afghan War did help to bring the Soviet Union to its knees. I mean, there were other factors as well, including oil prices and so on, but the Afghan War was a big part of bringing the Soviet Union to heel. So from his perspective, he will have seen this as doing the greater good. What's particularly interesting from that period is how U.S. and British intelligence officials have since revealed that they actually had a choice in what type of insurgents to back in Afghanistan, but they deliberately backed the most vicious and the most conservative and reactionary of the resistance on the basis they were most likely to win the fight against the Soviet-aligned Afghan government. And as you point out quite rightly, the PDP, the People's Democratic Party in Afghanistan, and their socialist government had been attempting to introduce women's rights, to bring basic education into the countryside, to initiate some sort of land reform progress. And all of those were dramatically reversed as this very reactionary Islamist insurgency started to roll back the Kabul government's forces. This, you know, directly led to the Taliban, a regime, of course, which provided a safe haven for al-Qaeda and all manner of other groups, which, of course, since went on to perpetrate attacks directly at the United States and the West.
My guest is Dr. Christopher Davidson from Durham University, and we're speaking about the U.S. and British role in developing the terrorist organizations that we are told are threaten us every day. You have a chapter in your book, and I've just begun to delve into the book, and you open any page, it's extraordinary, interesting, and fascinating, and there's so much facts you unearth. But you have a chapter about ISIS as the gift that keeps giving. Perhaps you describe that.
Yeah, you know, with ISIS, you know, this is a group that's, you know, done remarkably well over the past few years. You know, nobody's saying that this is like Operation Cyclone in the 1980s all over again. It's clearly not. But ISIS has certainly benefited from a vacuum, especially in Syria and especially in Iraq, and to some extent in Libya and Yemen as well. What we've had here, of course, with ISIS is a group that has essentially been fighting regimes such as the Syrian one, regimes such as the one in Baghdad in Iraq, which was moving closer and closer to Iran. So from the perspective of our main allies in the region, the Sunni Arab Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, and so on, groups like ISIS were actually the frontline forces against the Syrian government and against the Iraqi government, with on top of that a rather nasty sectarian edge, given that ISIS was carving out a Sunni conservative principality in the eastern part of Syria and the western part of Iraq that could essentially serve to drive a Sunni wedge right between Iraq and Syria, and more broadly, if we trace our finger across the map, to cut off this potential uninterrupted line of power running from Iran through Baghdad, through Damascus, and into Beirut. Their nightmare scenario of a Shia arc of power. And ISIS, you know, they don't like them. You know, a lot of what ISIS stands for is anti-monarchy and so on. But clearly, they had a green light. Clearly, they were receiving substantial funding from wealthy individuals and networks in the Gulf states over the past few years. From our point of view, we have Operation Inherent Resolve begin in summer 2014. We're told in the Western media, ISIS is the new Nazi Germany, ISIS is the new devil incarnate, it's World War III, you know, we have to defeat this existential threat to our civilization. But what happened? We have 3 years later, only now do we start to see ISIS being rolled up and done away with. What's been happening over those past 2 or 3 years? Very, very limited airstrikes, incomparable to the airstrikes over Saddam's Iraq in 2003, incomparable to those over Afghanistan after 2001, and even incomparable to those over Milosevic's Serbia in the 1990s. So this was not treated seriously as a threat to Western interests, and in many ways was allowed to expand, or at least be resilient, for at least 2 or 3 years, as long as it was taking the fight to the Syrian government and so on.
Well, it's interesting that Benjamin Netanyahu and a number of Israeli officials have said publicly that they're not as concerned with ISIS as they are with Iran. And in fact, ISIS has once accidentally attacked an Israeli unit and then apologized. And Israel has been made it public. They're treating any fighter who is engaged in the fight against the Syrian government. And so, but nobody in the United States says a word about Benjamin Netanyahu soft-pedaling ISIS. Iran's situation, and they say Iran is the major target, but of course Hezbollah, but the likelihood of this threat you mentioned of a bridge, Iran making a bridge through Syria to Lebanon, would seem to defy Iran's history, which has never, as far as I know, tried to go outside or expand its borders. It is obviously influential in Iraq because of the large Shia population there, and has a geopolitical interest in defending Syria as well as supporting Hezbollah. But the U.S. is continuing to push, and Congress is trying to find reasons to break this nuclear deal. You mentioned the possible threat of a world war, given the situation that's becoming more and more to resemble that preceding World War One. What chances do you think there is of a Saudi-Iran war? Iran is not Qatar. It has an army, air force, and this could involve the whole entire region and then into a world war. What do you think the chances are of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think from the United States position, of course, there's a lot of talk about the Saudi-Iran rivalry, and clearly, you know, the situations in Syria where Saudi and Iran are essentially fighting proxy wars through their various allies on the ground. It's looking really, really bad, and the situation in Qatar could well be the sort of tinderbox that sets it all off. That said, I think we need to balance that with looking a bit more at the U.S.-Iran nuclear deal, which, to my mind, was essentially a deal to facilitate the opening up of Iran's economy. I think despite what's coming out of the lips of the U.S. president at the moment, the U.S.-Iran deal does represent good business for the United States. There are major American, British, other European companies arriving in Iran as we speak. Boeing, for example, Airbus, ExxonMobil, and so on. So despite this public rhetoric about how the Iran deal is bad, it's actually not bad for the Western companies, and many are already there. You know, I've seen the flights take off from Paris and Amsterdam and so on, full of Western businessmen en route to Iran. So we've got this distinction between what the business world thinks about it and what the White House thinks about it. In my view, as far as the White House is concerned, provided that the Iran-Saudi standoff can be kept as it is, that they're both on edge, and that the United States and its companies can keep trading with both, that's ideal for it. It's a sort of balance of power where the U.S. doesn't need to get too heavily involved. You know, we can look to other examples in the region's history for this, notably in the 1980s where we had Iran balanced off against Iraq. Which ultimately prevented no one major strong regional power from emerging and threatening U.S. interests.
Well, Congress recently has tried to increase sanctions on Iran because they are kind of following Netanyahu's dictates. I mean, Iran has posed literally no threat to the United States. Claims are made about Iranians killing American soldiers in Iraq. Of course, American soldiers had no business being in Iraq, and one can imagine what the United States would do if another country was fighting in Mexico on our border. I don't think the United States would sit back and be a quiet observer any more than Iran could have been expected to be an observer in Iraq. But what we see happening is interesting. I know you're probably familiar with the plan of Oded Inan, this Israeli strategist back in the 80s who had this idea of breaking up the Arab countries, their neighbors, the ones that might threaten them into their confessional sectors, states, which seems to be happening in Syria. But I suspect there's something else today, that the Saudis seem to have the same agenda as the Israelis and probably have been in bed with them for a very long time. Well, what's your take on that?
I think we've got a rather strange situation developing now where former antagonists like Saudi Arabia and Israel, and we shouldn't bear in mind, of course, many, many older Saudis today grew up with images of the Intifada uprisings in Palestine on their TV screens, and Palestine remains a very emotive and emotional cause for many Saudis. But now we've got this very unusual situation developing where Saudi Arabia and Israel are gravitating quite rapidly towards each other, security dark ties, even some investment ties, and so on. We've sort of got two former U.S. allies that are now worried about a Middle Eastern future where the United States is no longer willing to step in as it did in the past and provide the sort of security guarantees that they previously felt they'd enjoyed, especially under the Obama administration and now even under the Trump administration. I think that sense of alarm is growing greater and greater, helping us to understand why, you know, Riyadh and Tel Aviv, which should be daggers drawn with each other, are in many ways having to cooperate with each other now.
Well, also, I mentioned this morning, the U.S. essentially is at war with Syria. Although the American public is not very paying much attention to it, but the shooting down of the Syrian plane in Syria by an American plane claiming self-defense and causing the Russians, who the last thing they want is a war with anybody, I believe, to cut off their, or to at least say they're cutting off their cooperation or collaboration with the U.S. This is like several attacks that have been made by the United States against Syrian military positions, but shooting down the jet plane seems to have been an escalation. And just yesterday, or Monday, the United States, the press secretary of Trump, Ron Spicer, said that they understand that Syria is planning another gas attack on somebody on their opponents in Syria, and that if that happens, the U.S. will respond heavily against the government and the Syrian military. And I've reported, at least from a number of experts, and today Cy Hirsch, that the evidence that Syria actually used sarin gas or launched a gas attack in April, it doesn't exist. So it looks like the U.S. is trying to push for a escalating of an actual war in Syria, much as if would have happened if Hillary Clinton had been allowed to take on that.
I think we've got stakes very high now. With Islamic State collapsing quite rapidly, we've got a sort of situation where there's a vacuum that needs to be filled. It's a sort of rush for all the groups on the ground in Syria to try and stake out their real estate. If we're going to end up with this sort of fragmented Syria, rather than the previous relatively strong nation state, it would help us understand why the United States has had to be a lot more aggressive over the past few weeks to make sure that its allies on the ground actually hold on to that territory before the Syrian government forces manage to liberate and reclaim it. With regards to sarin gas attacks, I mean, I think the best source on this, you know, I'm not interested in what bloggers or other people think about it. I'll follow Professor Postol from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, an award-winning missile and weapons specialist who's written extensively about the purported Syrian chemical weapons attacks over the past few years, which have all been used by the Western powers and their Gulf Arab allies to justify increasing intervention in Syria. You know, I think this is going to be one of those stories where it's very sensitive to talk about it at the moment, but in about 10 years' time, we'll all be looking back on this as an incredible operation of disinformation and propaganda. After all, how often does the United States release an official statement saying they're expecting an attack to take place or expecting chemical weapons to be deployed? This is the same United States which apparently didn't see coming the massive ISIS expansion in summer 2014, but yet we're supposed to believe they have a significant intelligence that yet another chemical strike is being planned. And the other thing to bear in mind is, why would the Syrian government do this? It knows that if it gets caught red-handed in a chemical weapons attack, it will essentially be giving full carte blanche to the United States or other powers to intervene militarily and destroy its air force. Given that the Syrian government now clearly has the upper hand in the current conflict, why would it do this? It doesn't make any sense whatsoever for Damascus to be doing this.
Chris, at this moment, actually, we've come to the end of the hour. You're asking a very intelligent question, the question that needs to be asked. Thank you so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World. I look forward to speaking with you again and reading what you write, because and reading your book in entirety, Shadow... Here it is, Shadow Wars, and I think you could get it online. I don't know if the local bookstores can get it, but you can try and order it. Thanks so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World. Take care.
Many thanks. It was a real pleasure.
This is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.